One of the great things I get to do occasionally is to do what I'm doing tonight and get to introduce the speaker. And I just a couple quick things I want to say about our speaker before I introduce her. One is I've stolen something from her that she said on a Sunday night, and I say it all the time. People think it's mine now, but she talks about in a meeting that this is not a think tank. We're not sitting around trying to figure out how to get sober. The work's been done for us, and I use it all the time. I remember when you said that one Sunday night, and I've used it ever since. Thank you. But I'll take credit for it, too. I do appreciate that. I work at a place in Midtown, and I was and sometimes we go on, we call them mindful walks. So we'll go on a little walk down for about 30 minutes down Piedmont Avenue, right by North Avenue. And one day, me and a group of about 12 or 15 guys are walking down the street, and all of a sudden this car flies by and it whistles really loud. "Hey, Joe," and whistles. And it was Lowry. And all the guys, you know, all the guys have been giving me grief ever since then that people just drive by Piedmont and start whistling at Joe. So I appreciate that too. So there's a lot that I appreciate about Lowry. But a couple other things I appreciate about her is her diversity, how talented she is as a comedian. She's an actress. She's one of the smartest people I know. She really is. And I think above all, for me, she's one of the most spiritual people I know. Walked in this evening, and she was sitting there by herself, and asked what she was doing. She was asking for God for help to give her the right words. And that's the kind of program I want. I really, really, really admire your program. I'm so glad you're here to tell your story. I want to give you Lowry to tell her story.
Hi, I'm Lowry. I'm in recovery for alcohol, addiction, depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. Don't be intimidated. I have so many diagnoses. Don't worry about it. I mean, bragging rights. But I was praying to God to direct my words, because my goal tonight is, I mean, of course I wouldn't be a star on stage and be like, "Oh my God, look at me, my life is so great." But really, it's not about me. It's about sharing my experience, strength, and hope with other people, because people have done that with me and it's been helpful. I know some people here, or I heard that some people were coming, because I have a psych part of my story. I do have I think dual is not selling it right. Like, I have a lot of diagnoses. It's more than dual. But, I mean, I consider myself an addict for anything. So not just alcohol, but pills, money, sex, love, you name it, I've been to the program. And then I also have depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it used to be like and then what happened. And then I'm going to talk about the things that I've been through in recovery, because I've been through a lot. And that's the hope that I want to share with you. So I'll start with my childhood. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. Woohoo! No, I don't flash my breasts at Mardi Gras. I know that's what you're all thinking. And I was the youngest of four kids, and my parents were still married. They were married for 32 years. They didn't get divorced until I was 19. And I was very privileged, and I was kind of a brat and entitled, to be honest. My dad was he still is. The man's 81, he's still working, but he's a radiologist, and my mom volunteered a lot, I guess that's what you would say. And we had everything that we needed. Like, we lived in a really big house in the Garden District in New Orleans. We had cars, like, you know, members of the country club. And I'm not saying that to be like, "Oh, look how great," but I want you to know that I was really privileged. So I was insulated, I was coddled. They didn't really tell me no that much. We had a housekeeper, so I call her housekeeper. She was really my nanny. She was there every day, and she was the one who used to watch Bob Barker on Price is Right. So I watched Price is Right at a very young age. And we'd watch the soap operas, because they were on back then. And we'd go play, and we'd do things. So I had a really close relationship with her growing up, much closer than my mom. So I do consider her part of my childhood. I started therapy when I was 16, so I have been in therapy since 16. I've been on medication since I was 19, which I know I look like I'm 30, but I'm a little bit older than that. So my dad, I asked him one time why they put me in therapy when I was 16, and he said, you were different, and he didn't really expand upon that. I know at the time what they told me is they positioned it like I was going to a sports psychologist, and they're like, you know, your Uncle John goes to a sports psychologist to help with his golf. We're going to send you to that for your volleyball. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. They're totally selling it to me. But they said that I was really hard on myself after volleyball games. Like, I was obsessed, and I would beat myself up. I mean, volleyball games, there's mistakes all throughout it. But, you know, I would do 10 things right, 2 things wrong, and all I could ruminate about was the things that I did wrong. And it impacted my mood, and I would play it over and over and over again. And so that's why they sent me to therapy. I was straight A student, I was in all the clubs, I played varsity sports, I was, you know, all state for volleyball, all district for basketball, I mean, whatever, I had accolades. But I never, I felt sad from a really young age. I remember very vividly, like, not being able to have the vocabulary to articulate that. But deep down, I just felt very sad at a young age. So I feel like that's always been with me. And in high school, that was when I started therapy and started sharing my feelings with someone, because my family, we didn't really talk about anything. And we sure as hell did not talk about depression. That's for sure. I mean, my mom was very Southern. She's like, oh, Larry, we don't talk about that. So I learned not to talk about things, and I was a perfectionist, so that, like, beating myself up over and over again, like, nothing was ever good enough, I wasn't good enough, and that's not the message that came from my parents, like, that just came from within, like, for a long time, I just thought that I wasn't enough, and it wasn't until I was in recovery that I'm like, oh, I'm more than enough, and this is exactly who I'm supposed to be, but it took me a long time to get there. I went to college. The first time that I started really struggling with my depression was my first winter, my freshman year. I don't know if, for me, my depression gets exacerbated in the winter, so the winter is a really tough time for me, in addition to the fact that I have depression year round. So my freshman year at college was the first time that I remember having passive suicidal ideation. I was walking, I was very unhappy at school. Obviously, it was a new school. I was a freshman. I was living out of town. I was living in North Carolina. My parents lived in New Orleans. And I was crossing the street very slowly, and I saw a bus, and I thought, I don't care if that bus hits me. And I didn't know for a long time that that was suicidal ideation. It took me a while to understand that, but that's the point that I can pinpoint. I started feeling those feelings. And my parents knew enough, even though I was out away at school, they knew enough that I needed to go see a doctor, so they sent me to a psychiatrist, and that's when I started medication, was when I was 19. So I ended up transferring to Emory. I don't know if you know, but we call Emory the Harvard of the South. Yes. And I loved Emory. I spent 3 years there. I got a 3.925. I remember, because every single semester I would get 3 A's and an A minus, and that's 3.925. And of course, I told you I beat myself up. So I was really dramatic back then. Although I guess I'm still dramatic now, so there's no change there. But I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I remember throwing myself on the floor and crying, and my stepbrother's like, oh my God, I would give anything for a 3.925. But that was the pattern of me being hard on myself. College, I continued to be on medication. I continued to see psychiatrists. I wasn't necessarily in therapy in college. It wasn't until I got out and I was in my 20s that I started going into therapy. So I've been in therapy a long time. And then my 20s, I started partying. I have or had a career, I'm in banking now, but I had a career in insurance, disability insurance. And it was one of those things that my brother-in-law worked there, and he got me the job. Not he got me a job, he recommended for me a job. Like, I got it on my own merits, I swear. I got the job, and then it turns up like 18 years later, I'm still in that industry, or was until earlier this year. So I struggled in my 20s with the partying. I grew up in New Orleans, and that culture, it is so embedded to drink with everything. You drink if you're upset, if you're happy, to celebrate, you drink because it's Wednesday. I mean, it's very embedded in the culture. So I thought my drinking during my 20s was normal. And then it started to progress. And there's like a demarcation in time where I really started going south. I lived with my boyfriend from 2006 to 2009. And in 2009, listen to this shit, he wrote a breakup song. He's like, oh my God, honey, I can't wait to play you my new song. Da-da-da-da-da. Like, I know you spilled food on the carpet. He put that in his breakup song, and he's like, and I miss you. And I was like, you miss me? I'm like, that's a breakup song. He's like, no, they're just feelings. I'm like, that is a breakup song. So like, my heart was just ripped to shreds, and I didn't have enough of the coping skills, and so that's when my drinking started to really accelerate. I was in so much pain. I mean, we had been looking at rings, and we lived together, and we had raised a dog together, which he got at the end of the breakup. But I just didn't have the way of coping. And then a couple years after that, 2010, I found the theater. So I was in shows or plays growing up, but I didn't really study theater. And in 2010, I started going to improv classes, and then I started going to stand-up classes. And then there was a theater at that time, it's called Relapse Theater, that's actually the name. And at the time, it was open in Midtown, and that became my community. So I was there, I was doing improv, I was doing stand-up, I was performing, I was drinking all the time, and then my community was that little improv theater, that whole improv community. I still dabble in improv, because of COVID, obviously the theater's been closed, but it is still part of my life today. So after 2012, the theater closed, and when it closed, it was devastating to me, because that was the only like community that I had ever known, and it wasn't well adjusted. I mean, all we did was drink and talk to each other, but it was what I had. And then all of a sudden, overnight, they shut down because they didn't pay their water bill. Turns out if you don't pay your water bill, they shut it off. So, and it was $30,000 overdue. So that was really devastating to me. So from 2012 to 2014, I started to rapidly decline, and I didn't understand what was happening to me. I was drinking more, I was calling in sick when I was hungover, I was missing things, I wasn't showing up for my family. And then it got progressively worse. I got a new job at the end of 2012, right as the theater was closing. And I had that job for only about a year. And in that job, so I had been on performance warning for not showing up at work. So because I already had repeated absences, I went and partied all the time. So that means sometimes in the middle of the week, I had a hangover. And when I had a hangover, I didn't go to work. And so after a certain amount of time, when you keep doing that, they put you on performance warning. So my solution was to change jobs. So I changed jobs, and I actually got a big promotion. I became a director of an insurance department. And then things started going really sideways. So when I was partying, I've been on medication since I was 19, but I didn't take it consistently. I took it sometimes. And I don't know if you know this about psych meds, but sometimes it's not good enough. Mixed with alcohol and drugs. So I loosely say that I've been on medication this whole time, but I wasn't really taking my medication, and I was partying, and then I started to abuse my prescription drugs. So it really took me a long time to admit that I was an addict, so that was very hard for me to stomach, and to admit that, like, I you know, I used my pills like they were, I don't want to say the name of the medication, but like they were uppers. And I started, I would use 30 in 30 days. And then it was like, I'll use 30 in 29 days. And then so on. And it got to the point where I was using like a 30-day supply in 7 days. And then I didn't want to be an addict, so I didn't go buy anything on the street. So that means I had 7 days of a pill. And then after that, I was just sleeping all the time and drinking all the time. So that addiction part was really hard for me to understand. So in 2014, that's when I went into treatment. It was January 2014. And the final straw that broke the camel's back is that my mom was diagnosed of cancer in December of 2013. And I didn't know how to cope with that. I couldn't cope with that news. I mean, it was lung cancer and it was advanced, so I knew it wasn't good. So I just couldn't grapple with that. I couldn't handle it. And so I reached out to my mom. And if you're a parent, I'm not a parent, but apparently when you reach out and say, I'm not doing well, they worry. So I reached out to my mom. I didn't know what else to do. And I said, I don't want you to worry, but I'm really not doing well. And so she called my family. And to this day, I don't know how they knew that I needed treatment, because they didn't know anything about my drugs and alcohol. They just knew that I needed help. And I don't know why that was the night that I asked for help and they thought it was suitable for me to come here. So they were gonna send me to Ridgeview for an assessment. I didn't go until that Sunday because I was stalling. I was like, no, I just need another day because I wanted to drink and use my pills. I was like, whoa, I gotta go out on a high here. I've got stuff to do before I go to Ridgeview. And I didn't really understand what was happening to me. And so I came to Ridgeview for an assessment. And at that time, they didn't know that I was dual, because all I talked about was my depression and my anxiety. I didn't even talk about my obsessive thoughts. So I was a depressed, anxious person. And so they sent me home. They didn't admit me because they didn't know that I was on drugs and I was addicted. So like, turns out when you're not honest, I mean, they're not mind readers. So they sent me home, and my family was super pissed about it. They told me later. But so then the next day, I called in for a leave of absence, and then I waited for my insurance to come through, and then that Tuesday, I started at Ridgeview. And I saw the doctor, and that was the first time that he diagnosed that anyone had told me I had polysubstance abuse. And that was really hard for me. And my case manager came to me because I was in the psych program. And she said, well, I think we're gonna put you in the dual program. And like, my brain was so fried at the end. Like, I couldn't really process information well. And like, I didn't really understand what that meant, but I wanted to help. So I was just like, oh, okay. And then part of that treatment process is they recommend that you go to meetings. And when you check in a group, you have to say, I went to a meeting last night. So I started going to AA meetings. I will say I also went to a lot of Emotions Anonymous meetings. I mean, that program saved my ass for the first year, because when I had a hard time admitting I was an addict and alcoholic, I knew for sure that I was a depressed, anxious person. So I fit into that. So that program really was a part of my cornerstone for the first year of my recovery. When I went to treatment in 2014, I was there, I was here, there. I was here in this lovely establishment for 2 months, which means I was out of work for 2 full months going through the program. And they ended up putting me in the residence for a week. And the reason they told me was because they were gonna take me off the pills. Like, I don't know if I was on it. Like, I think they pieced it together that I was abusing the medication. I don't think I was like Johnny Honest. but apparently they're smart and they're professional, so they knew. And so they wanted to put me in the residence. And that first night in the residence, like, that terror like still grips me. Like, I can still remember that, because I'm like, I don't understand what's happening. I'm in this place. I'm a grown-up, but they're telling me what to do. I'm not in my own home. I can't even take my medication. I have to have it locked, and then I have to go to a little pill container and like some woman watch me take it. and then tell me where to go and when to eat, and that I couldn't exercise because it had to be with a buddy. And so my brain, like I said, it was really hard for me to process information. And so, like, there was this moment of clarity that first night. It was that Thursday night. So I'd started treatment on Tuesday. They put me in the residence on Thursday. And I had a flash of clarity that I knew that I was an alcoholic and an addict. Like, I knew that in addition to my depression and anxiety, I was an alcoholic and an addict. But I could not handle that diagnosis. I wasn't equipped to process that information. So that flash of clarity, like, I knew that that was the first time I started to see it, but then I shoved it down because I couldn't, I didn't know what to do with that information. The first 8 months of my recovery, I mean, I call it my recovery because I have a lot of different diagnoses. I mean, I have a lot of things going on. It's not just that I'm sober. It's not just that I'm clean. Like, I'm in recovery for anxiety, depression, and OCD as well. And the first 8 months, I kept going to meetings. I mean, I feel like I accidentally got sober because it was not an intention of mine, and I was not counting time. I was going to AA meetings because they told me to do that, and I kept going to continuing care, and they chewed my ass up and told me I needed to go to a meeting and get a sponsor. And finally, at about 8 months, I went to a meeting, and someone asked me to do the reading, and I was like, I'm Laurie, and I'm an alcoholic. Like, I couldn't even say it. The first time that I said I was an alcoholic, I, like, totally stumbled over the words. But that was the first time I said it. And then when I had 8 months, I picked up a white chip. So this is, I was giving out the chips at East Atlanta, and I was like, does anyone need a white chip? I was like, I do. 60 days. Like, it was so wonderfully awkward. Like, and then a month later, I picked up a 9-month chip, and I know people are like, girlfriend, that's not how the math goes. I want to backtrack to my mom when I was in treatment. So my family was dealing with me in treatment and my mom in Nashville dying. And she was diagnosed as terminal while I was in Ridgeview. And so I was able to help process that through the group setting. And there was one weekend where she asked me to come visit. And I told her I was going to help my sister and babysit the kids. And she told me and texted me back and said, but I need you. And I told my mother no, because I knew that I wasn't stable enough to travel. I mean, that's so gut-wrenching to tell your dying mother that I couldn't go help her, but I couldn't help myself at that point. So I had to say no, and that was really challenging, but I know to this day it was the right decision for me. The other thing that turned out is because I was in treatment and getting this, you know, therapy and going to meetings, like, I started to get better. And when she was sicker, my sister and I had a conversation with her about a do not resuscitate order. So if you're really sick, sometimes you can say, I want an order, a do not resuscitate, so that if I pass away, you're not trying to give me life-saving measures. And so my sister and I had that conversation with her and said, we really need you, you know, we want to do what your wishes are, but if you want to, you can sign this do not resuscitate order. And that, it sounds weird, but that was a gift. So I had said no to her earlier, but I was there for her. I showed up for her. We had her, and she was like, don't cry. She was very big. I'm like, darling, don't cry. I don't want to see your tears. And so I was trying to respect that. I was like choking back my tears, but I was able to have that conversation with her, and I think that that was a gift to be able to say during that illness, like, you know, what are the wishes that you want. So I kept going to meetings, and I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't really intentional. It was just because they told me not to, and I'm kind of a goody-goody, and was like, okay, I guess I'm gonna drink. And I wasn't really counting time. Like I said, I picked up white chip and then a 9-month chip. But it wasn't until it was at 9 months that I got a sponsor. So I would not recommend that. In hindsight, it was not wise. And I kept going to continuing care. I mean, the whole reason I got a sponsor is I kept going to continuing care, and they kept telling me, like, chewing my ass out and telling me I needed a sponsor. I was like, okay, finally I got a sponsor. And I started to work the steps and get really honest with someone. And it was very powerful. The fourth and fifth steps were very powerful for me to share with her the shame that I had. Like, one of the things I forgot to tell you is that at the end, I was on conditional employment because I had gotten drunk and inappropriate at a happy hour. So they had an HR investigation and they put me on conditional employment and said, we're not going to terminate you, but if you ever do this again or make any kind of mistakes, we're going to terminate you. So, like, I had that shame with me. But I started sponsoring people, and then I started working the steps. And the fourth and fifth, like, that shame from being, I mean, it's really hard to be on a performance warning. And for alcoholism, too, they didn't even, like, send me to a program. They just put me on a warning, and I had to sign something. But I need a sip of water. Hold, please. So my life didn't start to change until I started working the steps. So somehow I white-knuckled it and got up to 8 and 9 months, but I would not recommend doing that. I dragged my feet. I did 1, 2, and 3, and I got stuck on step 4. And I would also not recommend that. It was coming out sideways everywhere. And so, like, I knew this whole thing about the 10th step, and so I was trying to do the 10th step, so I kept, like, making these messes and then trying to clean it up because I didn't want to have to put up my 4th step, and it was really bad. To the point where my boss had to have a conversation with me. She's like, I really need you to respond, like, positively to things, and I need you to have an answer for these things. I need you to be present. And, like, that was a hard conversation, but she was totally right. And the reason that I was doing all that and acting out at work is because it was my 4th step was coming out every which direction. So the 4th and 5th were really powerful for me. The only reason I got off the 4th step is that someone asked me to sponsor. So asked me to be her sponsor, and I was like, okay, I guess I gotta get working on the steps. So that was God's way of nudging me along. I also would not recommend getting stuck on the 4th step, but this was my journey and that's how I did it. And that motivated me to keep working the steps and to finish the steps so I could be of service to other women. The 5th step, like I said, was very powerful because it was the first time that I was able to share all that shame and everything I had done and everything that had happened with another woman, another person. And she just said, okay, what's next? Okay. And she had no judgment at all. And, like, the things I was telling her were, to me, pretty devastating. And she didn't have any reaction at all. And she's like, yep. Like, I did that. Or, yeah, I have a story close to that. Or, yeah, my friend did that. And I was like, oh, my God. So the 5th step was really powerful to me. I'm not going to go through every step, but same with the 9th step. I made amends, and God gave me these beautiful gifts where I wrote letters. So I made my list. I did my harms list. And then I, you know, made a list of who I was going to make amends to, and I started writing letters. So my sponsor had me write a letter, and then she'd read it, and then she'd tell me, no, you can't say all of this. Because it was always like, I'm so sorry, but I was really sick. And she's like, no. You just need to make amends and stop talking about how you're sorry or it's your fault. She's like, it's not meant to flog yourself, but at the same time, you don't need to put a disclaimer on it. And so because I had that list and I had worked on those letters and I was, reluctant to make amends to certain people, God gave me a few different moments where I met people that I thought I would never see again. And I was able to make amends because I had already prepared for that moment in time. So the 9th step was really powerful for me. And sponsoring women was also really impactful for me because it's not, I'm still self-centered and I'm all about myself and When I work with other women, then it's getting me outside of myself, and I'm doing service work, and I'm not thinking about myself for 5 minutes. And then it helps me, too, when I go through difficult situations, because I know no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. And so when I'm going through something difficult, that's when I try to see how I can use that for other people. So I've been in recovery for depression, anxiety, alcohol, substance abuse since 2014. I've been through a lot of different things in my sobriety. One of the big things was in 2017, I got really sick. I was in the middle of a 6-mile run, and I started throwing up and having intense stomach cramps, and I was 3 miles away. So it was the slowest walk and trudge back to the office, because I had run from the office. And then I texted my boss and said, I need help. And the security guard called the ambulance, and the ambulance came and got me and took me to the ER. And they did a scan, and they saw that I had a mass in my abdomen, and they told me in the ER that they thought I had lymphoma. And I was so sick that I couldn't even process that information. I mean, I remember my brother's eyes going really wide, and I was like, I'm too sick to even understand all that. So it turned out that was a gift from God too, because it was an incidental finding. That was ischemic colitis. That episode I had, there was no medical explanation from it. It does not happen to young people. It doesn't happen to people just out of the blue. And for some reason, it happened to me, and they did a scan, and they found a tumor. So I had a lot of peace when I had my tumor, when I went through that experience. I was sick from the ischemic colitis, and then I got better from that, and then I had surgery to remove the tumor. And then it took them 6 weeks, talk about alcoholic and addict, depressed, anxious person, 6 weeks for them to get the pathology report back. And you know what it said? It was like, you might have cancer. I was like, what? I need a yes, no. What is this cannot be ruled out? So I didn't even get a definitive diagnosis, because it was so rare, no one even knew what kind of tumor it was. I ended up going to MD Anderson for a second opinion, and they said I was cured. But that whole time, I was coming to aftercare, and I was sharing about it, and I had a lot of peace around that. I had a lot of serenity. I felt very strong, because I just had this very real connection with my higher power, and I knew that it was going to be okay. And it was scary, and I was sick. After the surgery, I had a lot of different complications. It wasn't I had surgery and then I recovered and went back to work. I went back to work and I was really struggling with these complications. But I had so much peace. And so I think about that part, in the big book where it says we can match calamity with serenity. And so I'm here to tell you, I went through having a tumor in sobriety and made it through and did it with the help of these amazing people, because I came to aftercare and the support that they gave me and the flowers and the balloons and the teddy bears that they sent me at the hospital. They came and visited me at the hospital, because I was in the hospital twice. I mean, this community really was there for me and loved me unconditionally. So that was 2017. 2018-19, I started playing guitar, and I moved to a different theater. So I'd been doing improv this whole time, musical improv, which you make up a musical on the spot, which is really difficult, because you have to come up with lyrics and a melody and a rhyme all at the same time in real time. It's really hard. But I can do it. And so come see one of my shows. This is just a plug for my show. No, I'm just kidding. So I found a new theater, and I had that village, and I started playing guitar, so I had new hobbies. And then in 2019, I was struggling a lot. So this is where my depression and anxiety comes in and really became the primary diagnosis. So when I was first in recovery, I started addressing things in the order in which it would kill me. And I knew the pill abuse and the alcoholism was going to kill me. And I didn't really realize the depression anxiety was lower down the scale. at that time. But in 2019, I came back to Ridgeview and I was crying, and I texted Eddie from the Access Center. I texted Eddie from the Access Center and said, I'm so scared, like, and they knew I wasn't doing well. I was going to aftercare, I was sharing about it, I was crying a lot. And he was there, he showed up for me, which I really appreciate. And then they admitted me, and that was the first time that I was admitted to the cottage, because the first time around I wasn't. And I was a dual diagnosis, but I was purely there for my depression and my anxiety. I mean, my depression was deep. So I stayed in there for a week, and then I came out, and then Don's here, right? He told me, he's like, what are you doing? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you're sleeping at home? I was like, yeah. He's like, you need the whole experience. And so he, thank God for him. And I was like, okay, well, I'm all in. I've been through this before, if that's what you think I need. So then I went and lived in the residence for 3 weeks. And at that time, my depression was persistent. I wasn't coming out of it. The medication wasn't changing anything. I see one of the members of my group, so love to see you, girl. And so my family, they rallied around me like they had in 2014, but they rallied around me. And I mean, it was to the point where I signed over a power of attorney for my finances and my medical decision making. So this is 5 years in sobriety. I was going for signing over my freedom to my family because I wasn't really capable of taking care of it anymore. And so after a month here, I wasn't getting better. My oldest brother, he drove down from Nashville in one day. It was a Sunday, it was visiting day. He drove 4 hours down, looked at me, he heard me cry. I was, not doing well, and he wanted eyes on me, and that's why he drove down. He visited me for an hour and got back in the car and drove back. And then he talked to my dad and my siblings and was like, we need to do something. This is not working for her. So even though Ridgeview is my community and Ridgeview's been here for me, but that was not what I needed. I needed something more. And so I ended up going to residential treatment. And if, residential is such an interesting experience. It's so hard to explain to people who have not been there. Like, it is a complete immersion into this environment of, like, warmth and surrounding. But you're, like, my focus every single day was supposed to be on my recovery. And at that point, I had 5 years of sobriety. And so it was kind of trippy for me to be like, wait, I'm in a residential treatment program for my psychiatric issues? Like, that was hard for me to digest. And the other thing is that I was doing everything that they asked me to do. I was going to meetings. I was taking my medication consistently. I saw the psychiatrist every 3 months. I went to therapy once a week. I sponsored. I called my sponsor. I worked out. I slept well. All of those things I was doing. And I still became sick enough that I had to go to residential treatment. And I was there for a month. It was in Tennessee. And then from there, I spent another 2 months in treatment at Skyline Trail. And that's when I started taking DBT. So I had been through cognitive behavioral therapy for many, many years. But when I went to Skyline Trail, actually the ranch too, they introduced me to dialectical behavioral therapy. And that, I did 2 years of skills, they call it skills training. I did 2 years of that. And that gave me a lot of tools to use for my depression and my anxiety. And then, a couple years ago, I was diagnosed as OCD. And people are like, oh, I wish I had that. My house would be clean. I was like, no, I don't even have that kind. Like, I don't even have the good kind of OCD. Like, I don't obsessively clean or check things. I have obsessive thoughts. And you can actually have a diagnosis of OCD, which is having the obsessive thought loops, which my sponsor thought was funny. She's like, you're an alcoholic and you're obsessive. Like, now you're surprised that it's OCD. So then I changed therapists and started going to an OCD therapist. But I guess I want you to know that, like, I've used a lot of tools in my recovery. So, like, those things that I listed off, I also had a support network. I learned DBT skills. I was doing cognitive behavioral therapy. I was open to it. I was still going to meetings. Like, that was real. Like, it's okay to not be okay in recovery, because on paper, I had 5 years of sobriety being clean and sober, and I was doing all the things, all the lists, and it still went sideways. I still was sick enough that I had to go into residential treatment, and it was very hard for me to understand that, because I'm like, I'm doing all the things, I don't understand. And, you know, I wasn't promised that life wouldn't be hard. That was not, you know, the big book says that I'm not going to take another drink if I do these and follow these steps closely. But there was no one ever gave me a promise that I wouldn't have challenges. And so, like, it would have been easier for me to cope with, oh, like, I stopped going to meetings, I stopped calling my sponsor, I stopped sponsoring. Like, that's not what happened. Like, I amped it up. I started going to a meeting every single night. And then I was fearful if I didn't go to a meeting. And I just needed more. I had to go to residential treatment, then I had to go to another 2 months of treatment. And that's okay. And like, that's a really important part of my story that I want to share with you, because, you know, just because I got clean and sober, this depression, anxiety, it still has a grip on me. And it's something I still struggle with this day. I mean, I've been going through a rough patch over the last couple of months. I was laid off, so I've been through a layoff in my recovery too. So my job was not going well. So I worked for an insurance company, and we'd been bought out, and we went through a merger, and it was a shit show, I'll tell you. And so my job changed. My job title and my pay rate kept staying the same, but then I would get a new boss and they would like redesign our work area and I'd have a totally new job description. And the most recent job was like, oh my God, they wanted fancy PowerPoints and Excel spreadsheets and like all this. Like that's not my background. My background is I have an extensive experience in disability insurance. I can write practices and procedures and guide you and problem solve, but I'm not like a PowerPoint guru. So I was actually on a performance warning. So clean and sober, recovery from my depression, anxiety, I was on a performance warning. And I actually asked her specifically, I said, can I get severance? And so I asked to be laid off, and she was gracious enough. You have to have a business case to lay someone off, but she made a business case. She said that she needed a project manager, which is not really, I guess it was true for her direction because she wasn't making it up, but she made a business case to lay me off. So then I got 4 months of severance. And I was able to get through that. I mean, it sounds like losing a job is, that's really difficult, but I was able to get through that. I did the same thing that I've been doing all along. I've been using my DBT skills. I go to therapy, I reach out to my sponsor, I do service work, I take care of myself. I eat a lot of dessert. But other than that, I eat pretty well, and I sleep 8 hours a night, and I take care of myself. So I'm doing all the things. And then I worked with a placement program, and I got a new job, and that was in April. So in this new job, I'm managing people, and it's banking. So it's different from what my background is, and it's not going well. I'm really going through a struggle right now in my life. It's really hard. It's the second job in a row that I've been not excelling at, and I'm used to excelling. And so, you know, with that, I've been, you know, my self-confidence has been a little bit down. I've been a little bit hard on myself about it. I'm like, why can't I get it? And it's just because it's so technical. But even though I'm going through that rough patch, like, I'm still in recovery. Like, I'm not in a treatment center right now. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to be clean and sober. I'm going to have some dessert. It's red velvet cake, in case you want the specifics. It's already in my car. I picked it up. There's some things that I still have not given up. Dessert is one of those. And I'm going to lay my head down, and I'm going to be clean and sober and in recovery. And sometimes my sponsor calls them do no harm days. Sometimes the best thing that I can do is do no harm. So I don't have to make any amends. I haven't offended anyone. My side of the street is clean. I haven't relapsed. And I haven't been perfect, but I did no harm to someone else. And so sometimes that's the threshold. Like, that is good enough for me. And so I still do all the things. Like, I still work on my DBT skills. I sponsor women. I work with other women. I do service work. like chair meetings. It's easy, you can chair meet. No one makes coffee anymore, but like it's easy to find service work. I take my medication, I go see my psychiatrist, and in fact, I actually see her monthly. So because I was so sick, I have never been released back to 3 months. So even 2 years later, I still see the psychiatrist once a month. And she just added another medication. So I'm still going through with it. I mean, I'm in recovery, but I also have an illness. Like this depression, anxiety is pernicious. And it's hard, but it's okay. Like I can be in recovery and still struggle with that. And I lean on people and I try not to focus on myself and I use all the tools and I get through that. And so I just wanted you to hear that I've had a lot of really great gifts in sobriety, but I've also had a lot of struggles, but I've gotten through it and I've made it here today and I'm honored to be here to tell my story. And so I hope I shared some of the solution. Thanks for listening.
A lot of honesty there and appreciate it. I'm sure a lot of people in the audience had needed to hear what you had to share tonight. Thank you so much.